The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
Welcome. My name is Dan Collison. I'm the strategy coordinator with the Baptist State Convention for the Metro Charlotte area. And one of the things that we, my team, the strategic focus team, we try to help our churches and associations stay focused on what we've identified as pockets of lostness across North Carolina. That is areas where in the Bible Belt South, we find unexpectedly high numbers of people who may have at one time said they were followers of Christ, Christians, even members of a local church, but are no longer active in any way. They're not actually walking that out. And there are a lot of places across North Carolina where within a, you know, mile and a half, 3 mile radius of an area, there's 65-70%, sometimes 75% of the population that is apart from Christ and no connection to any evangelical church, let alone a Baptist one. It's not contingent on them being one of us. But we do, we want to see progress made for the kingdom, regardless of what stream they're associated with. So anyway, in the Charlotte area, there's a lot of lostness. And in the pockets that have been identified in the Metro Charlotte area, poverty has been a significant issue in those. In fact, within the city of the city limits of Charlotte, we have 9 of the top 10 pockets of lostness statewide. 4 of those have a majority population of people who live below a livable wage. That's pretty significant. And about 25-30% of that population actually lives below the poverty line. So we'll get a little more specific with those terms later on. But today I want to give you kind of a broad overview of, you know, why poverty in the first place, like where does it come from and why should we care? And then begin to peel back some layers on, well, how do we deal with this? Historically, Southern Baptists and Southern Baptists in North Carolina have been a middle-class kind of movement. And so we don't have a lot of experience dealing with the affluent or the poor in our neighborhoods. And it's a little bit of a refresher course for us to get back in touch with things. So welcome, addressing the poverty of your community. Glad you're here. I want to start with this quotation. This put out by an organization called ATD Fourth World. You can look that up, and there's a lot of very interesting information that comes from that. But just let this sink in for a minute. The quote, just reading, one of the biggest myths about poverty in the U.S. is that poor people don't want to work. But in fact, most American adults living in poverty who can work do work. That is, 10.7 million American adults between the ages of 18 and 64 who live in households earning below the poverty line work full or part-time. This means an astonishing 59% of adults living in poverty who can work do so, yet they still live in poverty. If you ask most people in sort of a mainstream socioeconomic level, and they see somebody who's living in poverty, for a lot of folks, their first response is get a job. You know, if you just got a job, you'd have more income. And then they say, well, okay, if you got a job that's not a very well-paying job, like a lot of these folks, just improve yourself and get a better job, right? Well, there's some issues that underlie all that that make those really unhelpful things to say. Let's put it that way. So I don't know if you've ever read the book from the Chalmers Institute called When Helping Hurts, but it starts to pick at some of those things that are just, you know, kind of roll off the tongue responses to an uncomfortable subject for a lot of people. And so this is just, you know, one statistical look at America in general. We'll see some North Carolina specific material coming up here in a minute, but it helps us understand that things might not really be what we thought they were, what we assumed perhaps that they were in dealing with people who are poor. And so we move on to In your handout there, it'll be your first bullet point. What is poverty? And I'm just going to be straightforward about this. If you've done any exploration of poverty at all, or if it's an area where you might want to do some more exploration, you're going to find a lot of definitions about what poverty is. What I've done is try to get the one that, first off, gives the best overall picture of the situation that people living in poverty confront on a day-to-day basis, and secondly, do that in a context which supports a spiritual approach, a disciple-making approach. There are a lot of secular models out there for how to deal with poverty, engage with those who are poor, and make life better for them. There'll be some elements of that in our conversation, but that's not what we're about. If we don't bring with us the gospel of Christ in everything that we do, then we might as well just stay home. It's not gonna bring a change that lasts. But even as you heard in the opening session this morning, we do need to meet people where they are. And so we need to understand what their life situation is. So what is poverty? And to be really simple, I mean, these definitions can get very, very long. To bring it down to the basic elements, what is poverty? The extent to which an individual goes without resources. Now, a little parenthesis. This can not only be applied to individuals in terms of this definition of poverty and everything that we're talking about today, but it can also be applied to families and communities, even whole cities in some cases. It can also be applied to organizations. So if you're in a leadership role in your church or a nonprofit in addition to your church or whatever, you have an opportunity to examine how your organization functions in light of a poverty mindset. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on that other than to just acknowledge that it exists there. And these are transferable principles from one thing to the next. The extent to which an individual does without resources. Okay, what are resources? and why should we care? What types of poverty are there? What makes a person poor? These are all really good questions and would require a whole lot more time. Believe me, I've got a stack of books about this high. And I'm just scratching the surface of this. I happen to grow up in poverty, so that gives me something of an inside angle for the type of poverty that I was exposed to. But it doesn't provide all the answers. It's a very complex, very, very large topic to which there is not a silver bullet single response. It's a multifaceted thing. So poverty is a lack of resources. And here is just a sampling of what those resources are. There's an organization called the AHA Process that provides a framework they call Bridges Out of Poverty. They've identified 8 essential resources. These are 6 of those 8 essential resources that are necessary in order for a person to live successfully at whatever level they are, but then also to see improvement kind of across the board. These are some of the resources that we need to keep in our minds. One is emotional. There can be our ability to enter into a relationship, a conversation, an experience, and have an emotionally healthy response or contribution in that experience can make a huge difference on how we are perceived and therefore whether we're included or excluded. And if we're excluded, it becomes much more likely that we're going to experience some level of poverty. And so emotional resources are important to track. Mental or cognitive resources. This is not about, well, does this person have a developmental deficiency or is there a brain trauma injury? Those are important and those are a necessary part of a much larger conversation, but that's not what we're talking about today. In terms of mental or cognitive resources, what we're talking about is how much progression has a person been able to have in terms of their thinking. Most people who live in a poverty setting think of things very concretely. If they can't experience it with their 5 senses, they don't really care So I use a lot of generalizations in this. We need to understand together that every generalization has a lot of exceptions. But generalizations are generally true. That's why we use them. And so this is another one. There can be incredibly smart people who are still trapped in poverty. I'm not saying that there aren't. But what I'm saying is that this resource in combination with others, if it's missing for somebody, makes their journey a lot harder. And so, you know, what are the things that have developed them? What enables them to be able to move from a concrete experience of reality to be able to think in terms of the abstract? For all of the people in poverty, and even some that don't live in poverty, I ask a question, when I've asked a question, you know, can you visualize in your mind a triangle? And they're like, yeah, because they've seen lots of triangles. Okay, turn that triangle into a pyramid in your mind. Okay, I've seen pyramids. It's like Egypt, something like that. You know, okay, I got that in my head. Now spin that on two different axes, right? Spin it over on top of itself and around this way in your mind without any writing down, nothing, just in your mind. And a lot of people, whether they're, huh? That's abstract thinking. The ability to actually see those things in your mind when you're not experiencing it with your senses. Okay? Concrete, that's just one very small example of it. Concrete thinking is what enables, abstract thinking is what enables a person to be able to project themselves into their own future and hope for something better, something more. And then plan toward that, right? That's not concrete thinking, because that table isn't going to get me from here to what my life is going to look like 5 years down the road. But abstract thinking can. If I've not developed the ability to think abstractly, can I plan? It's a whole lot harder, right? And that's kind of the point. Spiritual. My context is Charlotte, so that's what I'm going to talk out of. Charlotte, one of Charlotte's nicknames is the City of Churches. You wouldn't really know that influence is part of the fabric of the City of Charlotte right now. It's significantly waned, much more so than Atlanta. I was like looking at what he was talking about with his pin drops for churches, and I'm like, oh, give us that, please. we'll take that extra help, but. Spiritual resources.
Just counting.
Spiritual resources are hugely important for a person to just live successfully in life. It is our contact with our spiritual selves and that spiritual contact we have with our Maker, our Savior, that enables us to think more compassionately and more caringly about other people. And the real motivation to do good. I mean, the other motivation to do good is to not get caught doing bad. So when you're actually motivated spiritually to do good for other people, it's a huge difference that has very significant changes in a person's life. What are their physical resources? What are they capable of doing? I once interviewed for a job, and they had the list of requirements, and it needed at least a 4-year degree, at least 5 years of experience, and blah 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 down the list. The last one was had to be able to lift 10 pounds. Yeah, I think I got that one covered. But there are a lot of jobs that are physically demanding. I worked for the United Parcel Service back in the day, and my job was taking parcels off of the conveyor belt thing and putting them on the right truck. I had 3 trucks I had to load every morning at 5 o'clock, by 5 o'clock. And, you know, I had to pick up those boxes and move them around. There's physical elements that work. Have you thought about people who work outside in North Carolina this time of year and through July and August? I mean, that's a physical demand on somebody's body. I can't do that. I just physically can't do that. I'd be in the fetal position over in the corner after about a week and a half saying, no more, don't make me go back. But that's a physical capability that people have to do work, matching up one's physical capability with an opportunity in their lives is really, really important. Support system. I think that one's kind of self-explanatory, so we won't spend a lot of time there. But if I'm experiencing a tough time, do I have people in my life where I can reach out to and say, hey, can you pray for me? Can you help me? You know, my kid's sick at school and I can't get to him or her. Can you go pick him up for me? That's one example of a support system. And people who live in poverty, for some things, they have a pretty strong support system. For other things, that support system is non-existent. It's only there when it's convenient for it to be there. And that makes life extra challenging.
There have been some studies shown that people in minority groups, if in their support system, their support circle, can include somebody from the dominant group in the community, their ability to improve their position radically goes up.
Yes.
And so support system can be extremely important as we address poverty.
Yeah.
Who are we including in the poverty area into a support system that includes links into the dominant system?
Right. Thank you for that fantastic segue to the last two items. That's great. It's a perfect example. Because relationships, otherwise known in the industry as social capital, relate directly to that. And there's a difference in social capital between bonding social capital and bridging social capital. Bonding social capital is people just like me who, you know, I enjoy having in my life, have a good time around. We might kind of move in and out of each other's lives, but there's a connection there. Bridging social capital is exactly what you were just talking about. That ability, I have somebody who I don't know how to do that, but I know she does. And so I can reach out to her and say, hey, can you give me some pointers? Or can you go down there with me? One of the critical elements that we miss in the national poverty conversation is for a lot of assistance for the poor. It's actually a requirement in whether it's the county services or federally offered provisions. It's like 3, 4, sometimes 10 pages of application form that you got to go through in order to even have a shot at getting that particular assistance. If you haven't even made a ninth grade education level, and if you don't have somebody in your social sphere, your relationships, who could go with you and help you or be an ally for you, then the assistance that's there to help people like you, you don't have access to it because you just can't get there. And the system is so overloaded that the social worker has no shot, really, at working with somebody. There needs to be an additional person, an advocate, a champion, and we'll get to that at the end. And then hidden rules. If I go to a party, it's a middle class kind of get together, and I moved it into the neighborhood. In fact, 3 years ago, I did move into the neighborhood I'm living in now. And a couple of weeks after we moved in was 4th of July. And on our particular street, it's a cul-de-sac, so the street gets shut off. All the families come out into the center of the circle, and there's a little bit of a cookout. You know, somebody brings barbecue, of course. And you know, everybody has a good time, just kind of chatting it up, catching up, and all the rest of it. Well, here we are 2 weeks in the neighborhood, and all these, there's no invitation for this. Everybody just knows it, right? Because some of these people live there for 20 years. And so there's these people gathered, putting tables up and chairs and food's getting put out. And we're like, but because it was all kind of middle class, we could go out of our house, go into the mix of people and say, hey, you know, good to see you. Our name is whatever. We just moved in. Oh, yeah, I saw you guys. Your moving truck and whatever. Welcome to the neighborhood. It's 4th of July. Hooray. And we just have this little get-together every year. And so I'd go around and introduce myself to the people, and they'd introduce themselves to me. That's a pretty fair, summary of what a middle-class social gathering looks like, right? If you're there and you don't know anybody, you're very free to introduce yourself around. You might not if you're an introvert, but you're free to. But if you go to a similar situation in affluence, and you're invited to come to a party that's thrown by people in affluence, and you go around introducing yourself, you will never be invited into that social circle again. You broke a hidden rule. In affluence, when you go to a party where you don't know anybody, the person who invited you there introduces you around. Very different situation. And in one segment of time, one 15-minute segment of time, you could completely destroy your ability to make relationships and affluence if you didn't know that hidden rule. Food is another great example of hidden rules. Typically, for people in affluence, it's not about how it tastes. It's not about how much of it there is. It's about presentation. Drives me nuts because we have this thing in Charlotte every once in a while. It's like food week or something, like restaurant week. What do they call that?
Taste of Charlotte.
Taste of Charlotte. There we go. Thank you. And in most of the higher priced restaurants, they cut their prices sometimes as much as 50% or more. And so you can go to an expensive restaurant for a little less expensive and you can, experience what that sort of, thing, and try a new restaurant or whatever, maybe becomes a favorite and you'd use it for anniversaries every year or whatever. Who knows, right? Well, it's still not affordable for me to even at half price to go to some of them. But my wife and I did go for one of our anniversaries during Taste of Charlotte. It's probably 2 years ago now. And, we're paying $25-$30, and that's half price for this meal. And I'm like, where's the rest of the meal? It's like, that's a really big plate, but you're giving me something this size I'm supposed to eat that's in the middle of the plate, and there's all this drizzly sauce and this green dressing. If only. So that's food and affluence very, very often, right? But food for somebody living in poverty is not about presentation. You can keep your little sauce stuff and your big plate and all the rest of it. We certainly can't afford those kind of prices. Food in poverty is about, is there enough? And generally speaking, food in the middle class is, how does it taste? Is it enjoyable? So you can have two families, one a poor family, one a middle class family, because an affluent family would never do this. But you can have both of those families go to a McDonald's, but they're there for different reasons. The reason for the middle class might be because there's the play place there, and the kids can go nuts, and then they come back and get their food and whatever, and they just want to be able to kind of stomach it. It's all right, we'll deal with that later. Somebody in poverty goes to McDonald's or to Burger King because you can get food to feed four people at Burger King for less than the cost of what it takes to go to the grocery store and buy fresh food and take the time to prepare it. We'll hit some more on that later, but hidden rules. So on to types of poverty, and that's where this little multicolored diagram comes over on the side here. So they're based on those resources. So if poverty is the extent to which an individual goes without resources, and if these are the essential resources, at least six of them, seven of them, that a person needs tracking in their life, then how does a lack of those resources actually express itself in somebody's life? So there are at least these five different ways, very broad, very general categories, but I've put them up here in these circles. So socioeconomic poverty is this kind of circle. That's the type of poverty we're most familiar with. They don't have enough money to go around. Here's a livable wage for this particular area, and here's what you make for whatever reasons. It's under the livable wage. In some cases, it might even be under the poverty level, right? Because the poverty level is much lower than the livable wage. But it's socioeconomic poverty. It's what rapidly comes to mind when we first think about poverty. But poverty is much bigger than just about whether you have money or not. Educational poverty is second. There's the purple circle here. So in those pockets of lostness in Charlotte I was mentioning earlier that have these very large populations of people living in poverty, the education is just plummets. There are a lot of areas in Charlotte where most people within a mile and a half radius have at least a four-year degree, if not graduate school or better, right? Not in areas of poverty. The sliver is very small for people who are well-educated who live in poverty. There are a lot of people, it blew my mind and broke my heart all at the same time when I first started to look at this material, because there are a whole lot of people living around us who don't even have a ninth grade education. For one reason or another, whatever happened, they didn't even finish ninth grade. It's like, wow. And then, a larger segment that high school is all they got. That's it. And, high school has its measure of value. A lot of that's dependent on what zip code that education came from, but it's of limited value. But there are a lot of jobs that are at that livable wage or higher. You got to have more than high school to get them. So if your general population is high school only or less, are they ever going to get to the jobs with a livable wage? They can work their tail off, and they're going to be challenged the whole way.
I see a lot of times people have high school diploma, but their education is eighth grade or seventh grade.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they have a high school degree, a high school diploma, but they are not there. They didn't learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that extends a lot further as well. The average 4-year college graduate in America right now reads at an 8th grade level or less in terms of comprehension and understanding and vocabulary. Right? So it's difficult. And in church world, we don't tend to think about this, but in church world, we got people who are seminary educated. Right? Graduate school kind of stuff. At least a master's, some cases doctorates. Talking to people who have a maximum of an 8th grade reading and understanding level. And if you're in poverty, that level goes down significantly. After that, some may not even be literate at all. And so we're waxing eloquent about Greek and Hebrew and Latin and all these historical allusions and illustrations. And they're like, Charlie Brown listening to his teacher. It just doesn't penetrate. It's educational poverty. Emotional poverty is another one. We've all seen it where people just fly off the handle at the slightest little thing. That's an example of emotional poverty. Now, here's the thing. People who are very rich financially can be very poor emotionally. So this is not a respecter of your socioeconomic level. But it is a significant a portion of the poverty conversation. So I was at this at a Bible conference. This was when I was up in Canada. I used to serve with the North American Mission Board as the the Send City coordinator for the city of Toronto in Ontario. And during that time, there was a very well-known preacher who was very direct in his particular philosophy and so forth. There was a Bible conference area north of Toronto where he came every week, and it was his week. So the opening day of his week, I happened to be there, and after the Sunday morning session, then they got lunch right there, right? So you line up, and it was really crowded. So only people who'd purchased tickets for lunch would actually be able to be seated in the dining hall. And so everybody's lined up, and this particular well-known preacher gets up there, and he's got his father with him, and his brother. Now, none of them had paid. He was the speaker, and he had two family members with him, but none of them had paid. None of them had tickets. Now, obviously, the guest speaker's going to get his spot. But he went around the line, and the poor person who was collecting tickets didn't recognize who he was. And so, you know, can I have your ticket, please? Tickets for all three of you. And his response was, I physically saw this. Don't you know who I am? That's emotional poverty right there. It's like, okay. They're paying no attention to that long line of people over there. Emotional poverty. Relationship poverty. And I think you're probably catching into what it is that we're talking about. So these last two, spiritual poverty as well. And we're not talking about spiritual poverty from the sense of, you know, Jesus, although he was rich, became poor so that in his poverty we might be rich. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about spiritual poverty that says there is a large disconnect between their heart and their brain, and they may be able to keep track with all the Bible trivia questions you can throw at them, but in terms of their heart being changed by the living situation of people around them or by the call of God upon their lives, there's no impact. So that's within the church. And then there's outside of the church where people, you know, we have a growing population of people in Charlotte who are like, you know, I kind of like Jesus, but I can't stand these church people. They're not like the blessing people he was talking about earlier. You know, we tend to be the finger-pointing, judgmental people, you know, and it just, nobody wants to listen to that, you know. But anyway, spiritual poverty comes in there as well.
Just out of curiosity.
Yeah.
I'm looking at all the five types of poverty,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to me that one of the most profound ways that you can affect most of them is by having in a poor community, a Christian school that reaches out to poor students, that will provide them with, will deal with the spiritual poverty because they're teaching them the Word of God, the Bible, that you have, you know, some sort of worship in it. Relationship poverty, that if you have an emotional poverty, if they have caring, like Holy Spirit-filled teachers there, and the educational poverty too. And that in time, you know, as a kid goes up through an environment like that, they've been nurtured enough so that they can make it from a socioeconomic standpoint. If I were to think of, and I guess that's why we talk so much about education in our mm-hmm. society. You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of the magic bullet. But, you know, What we're, typically when we're doing that, we're promoting secular education
mm-hmm.
without Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't deal with the spiritual poverty, which is the most, I think, the most important type of poverty that any individual faces.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that?
Good
research.
I'm glad to see you're wrestling with that, and we're gonna put a pin in that, because
okay.
some of the things we're gonna talk about will help us understand that. Demetrius.
Oh, I was going to say, like, I can address that because, like, I grew up in Christ. So if you bring this outside idea, like, hey, I'm going to put a school in your community, and I never asked you what you wanted or what you needed. I never asked that y'all have educators in your community to fill the school. It's going to be like, well, you got a brand new school here. Why would I come to this brand new school that I don't know nothing about? I don't know who owns it, I don't know who runs it, I don't know what you're teaching me, I don't know where you're from. Outside looking in, it's like, oh, well, yeah, I got a brand new shiny building, but you never even came and asked me what we needed to address these issues. It could have been easy as, hey, we just need education. I see what you're going with it, but I can see you just like, hey, we need like education and training in which skill development, grab a trade, like teach me a trade, or bring in jobs as opposed to just like McDonald's, Burger King, food law, like some type of job in which I can sustain a livable wage. Because I see people like, oh, we're just going to drop this in the middle of the neighborhood and there come to it. Like, I've seen grocery stores chain, like, major, like Harrison or Kroger, go into a community where it's like low income, like, oh, we'll put this grocery store here because they need fresh food and people still won't shop there. Because, like, I don't eat this food. How am I supposed to cook something simple like asparagus mm-hmm. or fresh green beans? I don't know mm-hmm. what this is. Whereas I'm going to this food line, I'll go to this Dollar General or Dollar Tree or Piggly Wiggly or whatever, and that's what I've been known to. So it's like you got to take little steps to change the overall picture.
So yeah. In a sense, there's kind of like for lack of a better way to put it, like a brand identification?
Yeah, you
can say that. Wow. People like in different groups have,
yeah,
in terms of like where they're comfortable going,
yeah,
and where, you know, and being a consumer, for lack of a better word.
You can say branding and also just be like authentic with your request. Are you just here to make money, or are you really here to like really make a difference within my community?
Mm-hmm. Good. So you guys maybe should have a conversation offline afterward, because that sounds like fun. Let me just close it up by saying, first off, if you're interested in bringing some measure of assistance, don't think of it as a short-term thing. Some of the most successful organizations that are seeing the most good happen will stand up and say, unless you're prepared to give this at least 20 years, don't even start, because you'll cause more damage than you help. So there's that. I wouldn't necessarily call it brand identity, but I would certainly say reputation. I was helping out with a street survey of people from one of our churches, and we walked through a very, very disadvantaged area where there was a church just down the street, and Vacation Bible School was coming, and there was a bunch of kids running around, and there's a couple of grandmas sitting up on the porch, just kind of minding what was happening. And, you know, so we went up, somebody from our group started talking to them about, hey, you know, would you want something for the kids? Well, sure. You know, this church down the street, they got Vacation Bible School coming up. Why don't you bring your kids on down for VBS? And they did a physical pullback reaction. They're like, why in the world would we bring our grandkids down to that church for its Vacation Bible School when they do nothing out here in the community the rest of the year, and all they're looking for is their diversified pictures for their Facebook page?
Yep.
I mean, I almost fell to my knees right there. It's like, oh boy, big issues are going on here. And we can think about it this way. What we're trying to do as the church is address spiritual poverty, but there are these four huge obstacles in the way to us being able to say anything meaningful into somebody's life about Jesus. Because it gets back to the concrete. Jesus, heaven, doing good, those are abstract concepts. You can't say, hey, come on, let me introduce you to Jesus. Now, you know, in an abstract concept, we demonstrate Jesus. We share the same teachings as Jesus. But if you're saying, come on, let me introduce you to Jesus, somebody in poverty is more than likely saying, I'm looking forward to meeting this guy. I want to shake his hand. And you're not going to be able to come through on that. So there's a different perception. And we have these huge obstacles to get over where we need to get back to the point, and I say back purposefully, we need to get back to the point where the church has more of a role in community than just Sunday morning, right? Sunday morning's great. We need Sunday morning, no doubt about it. But we have outsourced everything else about our community relationships that we used to have. Who were the people who first opened hospitals? Christians. Who were the first people who opened up schools? What was the original purpose for Sunday school?
Literacy.
Yes.
For urban factory workers.
Yes. Children. And the same thing in rural life. Yeah. So, we've lost touch with things that we used to do all the time. And we've become specialists. Well, you know how many people listen to specialists. Okay, addressing the poverty in your community as we continue with this. Why do people live in poverty? I just want you to think about this graphic for just, you know, a few seconds, right? So the conversation now in our culture is about truth, right? And the general perception of our culture is that there is no such thing as absolute truth. It's my truth and it's your truth. And we just need to discover where our truths overlap, right? So this graphic shows us that depending on your perspective, there are multiple things that can appear to be true. They are true. But when you pull back into the larger picture, you find out that truth is different from either of those true perceptions. Does that make sense? You follow me on that? Okay, so just keep that idea in your mind as we look at this. And this is on the back page of your handout. It's pretty small. You might need a magnifying glass, but I wanted to put it out there as a resource for you. In terms of the different people's perspectives on the causes of poverty. Okay, so this is not an exhaustive list. This is a demonstrative list to demonstrate how different groups of people tend to address the question of why there is poverty. So there's a large group of people who believe that poverty is a result of individual behaviors and circumstances. You're poor because you chose to be poor. If you didn't want to be poor, then you would just choose to start making better decisions with your life. And you would budget your money and you would stop smoking and you would, instead of spending money on fast food, you'd find a grocery store and prepare fresh food, even though you don't have electricity in your house or a refrigerator and a stove that doesn't work. So, you know, it's your individual behaviors and circumstances, and you can see the list there, and you know some of us may identify with these, but. You know, credit card debt and dropping out of education, alcoholism, street crime, you know, somebody's work ethic. Those are very, very popular, very common things to hear in a certain segment of our current culture. And then we come across the spectrum a little further to community conditions. And it's like, well, yeah, okay, you know, all of us bear a measure of responsibility based on our individual choices, but there's a larger context that's taken place around us. And these folks would say, hey, you know, it's middle class flight that's at least partially responsible. You know, they're abandoning entire areas instead of trying to help revitalize a community. They just leave. And or underfunded schools. That's a pretty passionate thing that a lot of people care about. I mean, North Carolina has made a lot of progress in terms of teacher pay in the last few years, but we still lag behind most of the rest of the nation on a cost of living comparison for what we pay our teachers. Did you realize that particularly for new teachers, they're not even given a livable wage for a significant profession in our community's life? Right? Teacher turnover is very high in the schools that are the most at risk. But what do at-risk students need in order to make that education stick? Yeah. They need consistency. They need reliability. They need to know that, oh, you say you're here for me now, but you might be gone tomorrow. That doesn't help, right? So we got a lot of these things. Plant closings. Down in the Charlotte area, we got situations like Kannapolis or Concord or Plaza Midwood, where there was a lot of textile industry kind of stuff. And once those mills close, it's like, whoa, Kannapolis hasn't recovered very well at all. Concord has done pretty well. And there's some reasons for that. But there's a charity that leads to dependency. You know, give a man a fish or teach a man to fish, you know. Well, there could be even another couple of options in that. Anyway, on to exploitation. And here's where things start to get a little sinister. It's like, this particular group thinks that there's actually somebody who is intentionally trying to take advantage of someone else's life. And you know what? There are people that do that. Is that the root cause of all poverty? Maybe, maybe not. Let's talk based on some of these topics. But payday lenders, if you've ever gone past a payday lender shop or paid any attention to what interest rates they're charging on that, if you don't pay back your full loan, interest rates can be as high as 150%. Whoa! Yes, absolutely. sweatshops, human trafficking. You're like, ah, we're North Carolina. We don't have human trafficking. You better believe we do. We have people in Charlotte who come from New York City to Charlotte for the purpose of taking people back to New York City. We have, I was talking to a lady who works for the company in the convention center that sets up and takes down the chairs and stuff for events. And, you know, a lot of the people that she hires, it's a very blue-collar kind of job and, you know, it doesn't pay a lot. And so there's a lot of turnover, blah, 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 all that kind of thing. It's difficult for her to manage to make sure that these things are set up for. But she says we've had representatives from banks, airlines, investment houses, and one other one, the government. That was what she said, the government, who have an event here and they've straight up asked me, do you have any employees who provide extracurricular services? It's a sex trade. It's what they're asking for. And, you know, it's like one of the things that Charlotte is bracing for right now is the Republican convention coming in 2020. One of the things that the people who are really taken by this particular approach to poverty are taken seriously in terms of that coming is, with that many Republicans coming to Charlotte, the sex traffic is going to go out of the roof, right? The Super Bowl is the single largest event on television that's viewed. It's also the single largest event for human exploitation. It's like, it's time to take the blinders off. You know, some of these things, you know, people get really carried away about and think that that's the only issue, but some of these things, they need to be included in the conversation. Drug trade, obviously. Here's a little note for you. I'm not going to tell you anything about either side, but do a little investigation about how crack cocaine, methamphetamines, oxycodone, how they actually got started and why it seems that there are specific communities across the United States that have a higher incidence than others. It's fascinating. It's also a little scary. And political economic structures is the last one, that the maintenance of power in the halls of government is only maintained by suppressing those who are under that government's influence. And yeah, we want to point lots of fingers at Venezuela and, you know, Mexico and other countries, but, you know, these folks would say we got a problem right here at home. And even taxation patterns. One of the things I've kind of track in Charlotte is, as you know, everybody who owns a home loves it that their home appreciates in value when you're in a seller's market, right? It's like, yeah, you know, everybody's tracking it on Zillow. It's like, yeah, Zillow says that, you know, 3 months ago, my house was worth 6% less than it is now. Yes, that's equity, which is fantastic. But what's attached to that equity? Property tax rates. And property tax rates don't tend to go down. So when they are assessed on that property, your tax bill goes up. If you're already riding the edge and you got homeownership, but it's tight, things are tough, and you might be working two or even three jobs just trying to stay afloat, and then your tax bill goes up for your property tax, and that's a pretty hefty one too, that might just squeeze you out of that homeownership. And then what are you going to do?
Especially if you're in like a historically poor community in an urban environment that's undergoing gentrification.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So just keep that in mind. Refer back to it. Think about some of those topics. It's really illuminating. The Bridges Out of Poverty perspective from the AHA process is to say, unless we're actually engaging, listening to, and bringing people along with us who think from all four of these camps, we're probably not going to have a lasting impact on poverty. And so we move on to why do people live in poverty? And I'm just giving you, this isn't even a thumbnail sketch. This is just a, you know, it's the skipping rock across the surface because there's plenty more to get to after this. But that you can, good resources for you to dig into. But here you go. There are three primary reasons for us to think about behind this. One is low margin. The second is tyranny of the urgent. The third is limited choices. So low margin. What's margin?
Difference between what you exist on and when the crisis hits.
Yeah, the difference between what you have and what you might need. That's your margin. The greater your margin, the easier it is for you to weather hard times, but also the easier it is to address things like when the air conditioner goes out, or if you lose your job for a couple of months, it takes a little while before you can find, or an illness hits the family. If you have some margin, you can address those things in a much easier fashion. If you have low margin, that is, you're riding that fine edge between, what you need and what you don't, what you need, having what you need and not having what you need, it can be affected by all of these areas. Low time margin. Some people, this actually rolls into tyranny of the urgent, the next one. So, but having a low time margin means there's just no space in your schedule. We tend to sort of glamorize certain things. And right now, one of the glamorized things in Southern Baptist speak is the co-vocational church planter or revitalization pastor. It's like, yeah, you have a job, so, that's, putting a burden on the church, but you're available to the church and able to provide leadership and direction. Some people do that very successfully because ministry world and job world help each other. That's perfectly done. But let me tell you something. If you're working two or three part-time jobs, there ain't nothing glamorized about that. Not a thing. It's really tough. It's hard. And yeah, there are all kinds of opportunities out there. You need some extra money on the side, drive for Uber for a little while. And after you drive for Uber for a little while, you'll wonder why you ever started. It's not true for everybody, but it's true for a lot of people. And all these, like DoorDash, I hope you tip well if you use those services, because if you don't, that person who's doing all that running around for you so you can stay inside, it's a hardship for them. So we just need to have these kind of perspectives about things. Low time margin, low energy margin. It's interesting, the people who need the most energy, that is the people who really need to be active, and if you're chasing after kids, boy, you need energy. And if you're working a job or two or three, you need a lot of energy. But the very people who are in that kind of situation are tend to live on a diet that gets in the way of them having that energy. And so it's very, very difficult. Low margin of thought. We just can't project ourselves into the future. This is called future picture. And a lot of people in middle class, we're thinking about retirement. We're thinking about school funds for our kids when they're going to university. We're thinking, it's like 5, 10, maybe 20 years down the road. We're thinking ahead to all this kind of stuff. Where am I going to go on vacation for next year? And I haven't even gone on vacation this year yet. But if you're living in poverty, your future picture is much closer. There are a lot of people living in poverty whose future picture extends only an hour or two from where they are right now. Because they may be at work, and they may have been reprimanded for a couple things because they had emotional poverty as well as economic poverty, but their kid's at school and turned sick, and then they got to make a choice between, do I stay at work or do I go get my kid? And the supervisor says, yeah, you can go get your kid, just don't bother coming back to work. Because he's got 10 or 15 people waiting to take that job. He doesn't care. But that parent is then put in an unwinnable situation, right? That's what low margin does to us in terms of time, energy, thought, money, obviously, and experience, and so forth. Tyranny of the urgent. Being proactive, setting goals, and planning ahead are not a part of generational poverty. Most of what occurs is reactive and in the moment. Future implications of present actions are seldom considered. that comes straight out of the bridges, out of poverty material. And so you're not responding to things, you're reacting to things. You're not planning ahead to things. It's whatever is burning hottest on your plate right now. That's whichever plate is just about to fall over, that's the one you go spin, and it doesn't matter what else is happening. You know, a lot of people in middle class and affluence wouldn't even dream of living that way. But sometimes that's what's got to happen. And then limited choices. Just going to give you some statistics here. So the state housing wage is $16.95. What does that mean? It means that for a two-bedroom apartment, so, you know, you would think in terms of a family of four, two adults, two kids, you know, family of four to get a two-bedroom place, including rent and utilities, the rule of thumb is you shouldn't spend more than 30% of your income on housing. Shouldn't. There are a lot of people who do, but you shouldn't, because you got other things you got to pay for as well. A household must earn $2,938 monthly, or at least $35,000 annually. The problem is that a lot of people never get to $16.95. The average renter wage, that is the average amount of money that a renter is making, is $15.29. So if that's your average wage and that's how much you need in order to have an apartment that fits your family, can you tell me how that's possible? And worse than that, can you tell me how you're supposed to get together your first and last, your security deposit, and, you know, get your power bill started with a deposit all at the same time? Like, this, it doesn't work. It's pretty hard to see happen. And then when you look at the fact that there's 1.3, almost 1.4 million renter households in North Carolina, that goes pretty badly pretty quickly. We're not going to go through this slide in detail. I just wanted to show you that. And then also to show you these are the current most expensive areas to live in North Carolina. And so big difference. I don't know where Currituck County is. Does anybody know that?
It's Northeast Corner.
Okay. $21.23.
Right near
Virginia.
Norfolk.
Overflow. Okay. So then I wanted to show you this, right? So here's $38,680. This is Mecklenburg County statistics, by the way. $38,680 is the income needed to afford a two-bedroom apartment in Mecklenburg County. Look at the jobs that would not qualify on average for that level of income. And I don't know why they didn't put teachers in here, because I wish they had. Teachers would be on this side, not on this side. Cabarrus County, just north of Charlotte. Doesn't matter what the school situation is. Doesn't matter what your kid's situation is. Each teacher is allowed $100 per year to decorate their classroom and provide school supplies for their students. So the next time on Facebook you see one of those teachers putting up their Amazon list for school supplies for their kids, please buy something. You're making a difference for her or him, for the teacher, and for the students that she's trying to serve. And then look at this. Last year in Mecklenburg County, 30,049 families faced eviction. That's 38% of all the renters in the city, in the county, sorry. And then 579 families in Mecklenburg County faced a foreclosure. And that's 1.3% of all cost burden homeowners. So the situation is real, and it's also urgent. The thing that is lagging the most is what the church is supposed to do about it, or will do about it. But in North Carolina, 26,361 public school students experienced homelessness last year in North Carolina. Wow. One quarter of the homeless population in Charlotte right now lives in their car. And it's not the down and outers. These are people who, I personally know a firefighter who lives with his family in his car. I know, my wife knows, a colleague of hers, my wife's a nurse in Northeast Hospital in Cabarrus County. One of her coworkers working for a hospital system lives in her car, gets a Planet Fitness membership so she has a place to shower because it's only $10 a month. And she works overtime regularly. She's one of the hardest working people in that entire floor area that my wife has exposure to. 26,361 public school students experienced homelessness. We're about done here, aren't we? Does God care about poverty? Let me ask you if any of these might help you understand that. Whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker, but he who is generous to the needy honors him. Do not take advantage of a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether that worker is a fellow Israelite or a foreigner residing in one of your towns. Pay them their wages each day before sunset, because they are poor and are counting on it. Otherwise, they may cry to the Lord against you, and you will be guilty of sin. If anyone is poor among your fellow Israelites in any of the towns of the land of the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward them. Defend the weak and the fatherless. Uphold the cause of the poor and the oppressed. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. And my list continues, but I'm gonna pull it up there because that is what it comes to. What can I do about poverty? What are the things that individually we can make a difference in? There's these four things. Look where you may have chosen to no longer see. You got to start seeing the stuff that you're ignoring. Okay, blinders off. You got to care. Feel the weight of poverty on your shoulders. Don't dismiss it with some ridiculous little statement that keeps you safe, but keeps you away from them. No, learn about poverty, the poor, and the struggles they face, and then act. Find somewhere to plug in and be the difference. And then what can we do about poverty together? When Helping Hearts from the Chalmers Institute says, reconciliation of relationships is the guiding compass to our poverty alleviation efforts, profoundly shaping both the goals that we pursue and the methods we use. If reconciliation of relationships is the guiding compass, what should the church be really good at? The ministry of reconciliation among people who God has created, right? How do we do that? First off, recognize it takes a team. Your church on its own will not move the needle on poverty, will not be able to overcome the other expressions of poverty in order for you to deal effectively with spiritual poverty. It takes a team. You need to identify some really good quality nonprofits. One in Charlotte that you actually just saw that slide for about the homeless kids, Hope Vibes in Charlotte is a fantastic nonprofit, gospel-based, that is just ready and willing to come alongside any church to help them grapple with homelessness. And there are a whole lot of others as well. It takes a team. Pick a spot and fill it well. So a lot of times we settle for the good and we neglect the better and the best. But there are also times when we're like, "Yeah, it's good enough," and it's just not. And then we need to become advocates, champions, and allies for those who are poor. Scripture tells us, we just read that verse, right? Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and the needy. They don't have anybody who's doing that without an agenda currently. How refreshing it would be for the saints of God to be the advocates for the poor and needy, not with an agenda, but because we love them, because Christ first loved us.